Angelina Jolie herself will also have to come to terms with someday, and probably already struggles with now. Real change happens on the level of the gesture. It's one person doing one thing differently than he or she did before. It's the man who opts not to invite his abusive mother to his wedding. The woman who decides to spend her Saturday mornings in a drawing class instead of scrubbing the toilets at home. The writer who won't allow himself to be devoured by his envy. The parent who takes a deep breath instead of throwing a plate. It's you and me standing naked before our lovers, even if it makes us feel kind of squirmy in a bad way when we do. The work is there. It's our task. Doing it will give us strength and clarity. It will bring us closer to who we hope to be. You don't have to be young. You don't have to be thin. You don't have to be hot in a way that some dumbfuckedly narrow mindset has construed that word. You don't have to have taut flesh or a tight ass or an eternally upright set of tits. You have to find a way to inhabit your body while enacting your deepest desires. You have to be brave enough to build the intimacy you deserve. You have to take off all of your clothes and say, "I'm right here." There are so many tiny revolutions in a life, a million ways we have to circle around ourselves to grow and change and be okay. And perhaps the body is our final frontier. It's the one place we can't leave. We're there till it goes. Most women and some men spend their lives trying to alter it, hide it, prettify it, make it what it isn't, or conceal it for what it is. But what if we didn't do that? That's the question you need to answer wanting. That's what will bring your deepest desires into your life. Not, will my old droopy male contemporaries accept and love the old droopy me? But rather, what's on the other side of the tiny gigantic revolution in which I move from loathing to loving my own skin? What fruits would that particular liberation bear? We don't know, as a culture, as a gender, as individuals, you and I. The fact that we don't know is feminism's one true failure. We claimed the agency, we granted ourselves the authority, we gathered the accolades, but we never stopped worrying about how our asses looked in our jeans. There are a lot of reasons for this, a whole bunch of big sexist things we can rightfully blame. But ultimately, like anything, the change is up to us. The culture isn't going to give you permission to have robust, adventurous sex with your droopy and aging body. So you're going to have to be brave enough to take it for yourself. This will require some courage wanting, but courage is a vital piece of any well-lived life. I understand why you're afraid. I don't mean to diminish the enormity of what's recently ended and what now will begin. But I do intend to say to you very clearly that this is not the moment to wilt into the underbrush of your insecurities. You've earned the right to grow. You're going to have to carry the water yourself. So let's talk about men. A whole bunch of them will overlook you as a lover because they want someone younger and firmer, but not all of them will. Some of them will be thrilled to meet a woman just exactly like you. The sexiest, not culturally sanctioned sexy people I know, the old, the fat, the differently abled, the freshly postpartum, have a wonderful way of being forthright about who they are, and I suggest you take their approach. Instead of trying to conceal the aspects of your body that make you feel uncomfortable, how about just coming out with it at the outset, before you get into the bedroom and try to slip unnoticed beneath the sheets while having a panic attack? What would happen if you said to Mr. Just About to Do Me, "I feel terribly self-conscious about how droopy my body is, and I'm not sure if I even really know how to have good sex anymore, since I was frozen in a boring pattern with my ex for years on end"? In my experience, those sorts of revelations help. They unclench the stronghold of one's fears. They push the intimacy to a more vulnerable place. And they have a spectacular way of revealing precisely the sort of person one is about to sleep with. Does he laugh and say he thinks you're lovely, so just hush up? Or does he clear his throat and offer you the contact information for his ex-wife's plastic surgeon? Does he confess his own insecurities or lecture you appallingly about yours? Is he the fellow you really want to share your body with? Or had you better walk away while the getting's good? I know as women, we're constantly being scorched by the relentless porno Hollywood beauty blowtorch. But in my real life, I've found that the men worth fucking are far more good-natured about the female body in its varied forms than is generally acknowledged. Naked and smiling is one male friend's only requirement for a lover. Perhaps it's because men are people with bodies full of fears and insecurities and shortcomings of their own. Find one of them. One who makes you think and laugh and come. Invite him into the tiny revolution in your beautiful new world. Yours, Sugar. Not enough. Dear Sugar, last year I met a guy who is wonderful, though I recognize he has a lot of growing up to do. He's 24. We get along well, have a similar sense of humor, and have great sex. After 9 months, I still get a tingle in my gut when I see him. Our relationship started casually, but over time we got to know each other and became ourselves around each other. We can cook together and be silly and go on adventures and read to each other and have sex on the floor and then make a cake and eat it in bed. In the beginning, I was okay with us not being monogamous. But once our relationship became more than a fling, I wanted a commitment. We talked and he told me that sleeping with just one person could get boring, but that he clearly likes me, or else he wouldn't spend time with me. He said he was afraid I would change him somehow, turn him into someone he's not. I didn't understand him then, and I still don't. Am I just dense? He likes me, but not enough to say he likes only me? Maybe it's that simple. We still see each other pretty often, just now without the sex. I care for him, but I don't know if I'm foolish to stick around to see where it goes. Am I torturing myself by keeping him a part of my life? Best, Needs Direction. Dear Needs Direction, I receive a lot of letters like yours. Most go on at length, describing all sorts of maddening situations and communications in bewildered detail. But in each there is the same question at its core. Can I convince the person about whom I'm crazy to be crazy about me? The short answer is no. The long answer is no. The sad but strong and true answer is the one you already told yourself. This man likes you, but not the way you like him. Which is to say, not enough. So now you get to decide what you want to do about that. Are you able to be friends, or even occasional lovers, with this man who is less crazy about you than you are about him, without feeling A, bad about yourself, B, resentful of him, or C, like you're always longing for more? If the answer is not yes on all three counts, I suggest you give your friendship a rest, even if it's just for the time it takes you to get over him. There are so many things to be tortured about, sweet pea. So many torturous things in this life. Don't let a man who doesn't love you be one of them. Yours, Sugar. No is golden. Dearest Sugar, I'm writing to you with half the answer already in my heart. I felt I should say this up front, since conventional wisdom says that no matter what advice a mixed-up person gets, they always end up following their own. My question is about my upcoming wedding, which my fiancé and I are planning to have at his father's house in Europe. Because I'm from the United States, my guests will be far fewer, and I have to think a lot harder about who merits an invite. At 30, I feel like I've reached a point in my life where I'm doing all the things necessary to move forward without forgetting my past. I've been in therapy for the past year, trying to come to terms with a childhood filled with all the usual pitfalls that cause kids to grow up into bitter, emotionally damaged adults. Alcoholism, drug abuse, physical and emotional abuse, along with a mother who depended on me from the time I was 5 to assure her that my father wasn't dead in an accident on some dark road somewhere, all caused me to live most of my 20s on a precarious ridge between responsible living and disastrous freefall. But I got lucky. I got away from my family and lived in another country. I found the forgiveness within me to reestablish a relationship with my mother. I gathered the courage to achieve what I refer to as normality. People underestimate the importance of normality. Normality means no one is screaming, fighting, or insulting one another. Normality means I'm not sobbing in my room. Normality means Christmas and other family holidays are a joy. Normality means, for some people, getting married. And so here I am, getting married to a sincere, sensitive man with a perfectly normal family, who will, for the first time, meet my dysfunctional, fractured, and still very unaware of it all family members. This scares me to death. But what scares me most is my father, who is the person at the source of most of the pain I felt as a child. I'm torn about whether I should invite him to my wedding. After years of non-communication, my father, though in possession of many, many, many faults, has recently found his way back into my life. He is a big part of my youngest brother's life. And now my fiancé wants to include him in our wedding. The last time I saw my father, he was stoned out of his mind and drunk. He was supposed to drive my brother and me to the train station, and didn't. So I'm conflicted. I don't expect my wedding day to be perfect. Part of me feels like, despite all the drama that could occur, maybe this is an opportunity to include my father in an important part of my life, and that this could be healing for him, and even cathartic to some extent. But then I imagine my mother's face when my father has drunk a few too many, while my fiancé's family looks on in horror. My father isn't the friendly, funny kind of drunk. I want to turn the proverbial page, but my hand is frozen, unable to make a decision. The easiest thing to do would be to just not invite him, not run the risk, so I won't have to be nervous on our day. But I never have chosen the easiest thing. Please help. Daughter with maybe expired daddy issues. Dear daughter, every time I read your letter, a terrible screeching alarm goes off in my head. Please don't invite your father to your wedding. There isn't one word in your letter that tells me you want to or should. Let us first dispatch with your fiancé, since he, not you, is the one who'd like to include your father in your wedding. I presume he had good intentions when he proposed this. Hollywood-inspired visions of profound revelations and touching reunions brought on by the magic of the day, no doubt. But you know what? His opinion on this matter has no bearing whatsoever. The decision about whether to invite your father isn't even a tiny bit up to him. Your fiancé's suggestion tells me that he has neither a clear understanding of your familial history nor an awareness of your deeply dysfunctional dad. I suggest you have an exhaustive conversation with him on these subjects rather soon. Like, now. I commend you for working so hard to come to terms with your childhood. I know how painful that is to do, and I know how very much richer your life is for having done so. But as you are surely aware, forgiveness doesn't mean you let the forgiven stomp all over you once again. Forgiveness means you found a way forward that acknowledges harm done and hurt caused without letting either your anger or your pain rule your life or define your relationship with the one who did you wrong. Sometimes those we forgive change their behavior to the extent that we can eventually be as close to them as we were before, or even closer. Sometimes those we forgive continue being the jackasses that they always were, and we accept them while keeping them approximately 3,000 miles away from our wedding receptions. It sounds to me like your father fits into the latter category, which means you need to look sharp. If the words love, light, acceptance, and forgiveness are written on one side of the coin you've earned by creating the beautiful life you have in the wake of your ugly childhood, on the other side of that coin, there is written the word no. No is golden. No is the kind of power the good witch wields. It's the way whole, healthy, emotionally evolved people manage to have relationships with jackasses while limiting the amount of jackass in their lives. I'm talking, of course, about boundaries. I'm talking about taking a level gaze at, quote, the man at the source of most of the pain, and making an informed decision about an important event in your life, in which you put yourself and your needs and your desires front and center. It's really very clear when you think about it, isn't it? Your father wronged you as a child. He wronged you as a woman. And he will very likely wrong you on your wedding day if you give him the opportunity to do so. This is not because he doesn't love you. But love doesn't make a mean drunk not a mean drunk, or a narcissist not a narcissist, or a jackass not a jackass. At your wedding, your father will most likely behave the way he has behaved for all the years you've known him. Even if he doesn't, what's the best case scenario? That you spend your wedding day worrying that your father is going to make an ass of himself and humiliate you and enrage your mom and alienate your in-laws, but he doesn't? Does that sound like fun? Is that what you hope for? Is that what you want? Of course not. You want your father to be a prince. And if he can't be that, you at least want him to be a decent human being. You want the enormity of your big day to be bigger than whatever measly little shit shack he's been living in all of your life. I know this. I understand that ache. When I think about my own father for more than 5 seconds at a stretch, I can still feel my daddy's sorrow all the way down to the very tips of my toes. Oh, but baby girl, your father is not going to do anything you want him to do because you want him to do it. Not one damn mother-loving thing. You simply didn't get that kind of dad. You got the kind who will only do what he can. That you've gone to the door of his shit shack and knocked is a noble act. The strength and faith you called upon when you sought to repair your relationship with your father will shine through your life, regardless of what happens between the two of you. That is a magnificent thing, daughter. It was created entirely by your grit and your grace. It belongs to you. Let it be the thing that guides you when you speak to your father about why he isn't invited to your wedding. You wrote that not inviting him is the easiest thing to do, but I encourage you to make it the hardest thing. Use your decision as an opportunity to have a frank conversation with him about how his behavior affects you and your ability to truly let him back into your life. If your father is a man worthy of your deepening affection, he'll respect your decision even if his feelings are hurt. He'll understand that his exclusion is not a punishment, but rather a consequence of his lifetime of poor fathering and bad behavior. He'll tell you that there are other ways for him to celebrate your marriage, and he'll find a way to do it. If he's not a man worthy of your deepening affection, he'll throw a fit. He'll blame you for his failures. He'll tell you that you're selfish and mean. Possibly he'll X you out of his life. Or maybe it won't mean anything to him that his conduct is so deplorable that his daughter has chosen to exclude him from her wedding. Perhaps he'll simply let this, like so much else, roll right on by. But you know what? No matter what he does, one thing is certain. He won't screw up your wedding day, which really should be perfect, or as close to perfect as it can be. And hard and sad as it is, it's up to you alone to make it that way, just like it's been up to you to make your perfect life. I know it will be, dear one. I don't even need an invitation to see. Yours, Sugar. Romantic love is not a competitive sport. Dear Sugar, I'm a 25-year-old woman who started dating a wonderful man a couple of months ago. He's smart, good-natured, funny, and he definitely turns me on. I'm extremely happy to have met him, and even happier that he likes me as much as I like him. Our sex life is great, but my man has this bad habit of mentioning past sexual experiences. He doesn't go into detail, and I don't think he realizes his stories bother me. I think he genuinely trusts me and simply wants to talk about these things. Recently, he started to tell me that he'd once been in an orgy. I stopped him and said, "I'm sorry, but I don't want to know anything about this." He was not upset, and he respected my request. But now this image is floating around in my head, constantly, haunting me. I keep imagining what it was like, what he was like, what the women were like, and it's making me sick. Sick with jealousy, sick with insecurity, sick with fear. It intimidates me, makes me feel crazy. I'm not worried that he's going to cheat on me to go have another orgy, but I do worry that maybe I won't be enough to satisfy him. I don't know what to do. This image is still in my head, as are others, but I don't know if talking with him about it, i.e. finding out more details that my imaginative little mind will feast on in potentially terrible ways, will help or just make it worse. Is this something that if left alone, I'll eventually just realize is a natural part of his healthy sexual past? Or do I need to tell him how it makes me feel, at risk of sounding like an irrational, insecure, jealous woman who doesn't trust him, possibly pushing him away? And if I do have to talk to him about it, how can I keep from fanning the crazed fire that's already burning in my head? Love, haunted by his sexual past. Dear haunted by his sexual past. So let me see. Your boyfriend is 1. Wonderful. 2. Extremely smart. 3. Good-natured. 4. Funny. 5. Terrific in bed. 6. As into you as you are into him. 7. Trusting. 8. Trustworthy. 9. Respectful. 10. Interested in talking intimately with you about his life. Am I going to have to remove my silk gloves and bop you with them? You aren't haunted by your boyfriend's sexual past. You're haunted by your own irrational, insecure, jealous feelings. And if you continue to behave in this manner, you will eventually push your lover away. I don't mean to be harsh, darling. I'm direct because I sincerely want to help you, and because it's clear to me that you're an incredibly good egg. I know it's a kick in the pants to hear that the problem is you, but it's also fucking fantastic. You are, after all, the only person you can change. So let us dismantle your mania. You say that your knowledge of your lover's past sexual experiences makes you feel jealous and insecure and afraid that you won't be, quote, enough to satisfy him. Really? One thing about love, especially free, unfettered, and uncommitted love such as the kind you and your man are in, is that people pretty much do what they want to do. If you weren't enough to satisfy him, you'd know it because he wouldn't be with you. The fact that he is means he likes you a lot, and he doesn't want to be with all the other women he's fucked, or at least not all that much. Contrary to what the Bachelor, Bachelorette television franchise and the entire spirit-decimating Hollywood industrial complex would have you believe, romantic love is not a competitive sport. Some of those women your boyfriend used to fuck have nicer asses than you. Some are smarter or funnier or fatter or more generous or more messed up than you. That's okay. That has no bearing on you whatsoever. You're not up against those women. You're running your own race. We don't dig or not dig people based on a comparison chart of body measurements and intellectual achievements and personality quirks. We dig them because we do. This guy, your lover, my anxious little peach, he digs you. Don't ruin it because at some point in time he dug other women too. Of course you're going to get a pinchy feeling inside when you think of those women rubbing up against your man. I get that. I know what that's like. It was not so long ago that I was standing in my basement and I came across an envelope addressed to Mr. Sugar, and when I picked it up, out fell about 7,000 little bits of glossy paper that if you put them all together would be a photograph of the woman who was the last woman Mr. Sugar had sex with who wasn't me. And this woman was not just any woman, but an impossibly lithe modern dancer. Her body so tight and taut and bitch-fiddle-esque, I might as well be the Pillsbury Doughboy. And these 7,000 pieces were not the result of Mr. Sugar ripping up the photograph because he didn't want to see the image of the last woman he had sex with who wasn't me anymore. No. This was a love puzzle she made for him. I know because I also read the card inside, which basically said, "Come and get me, tiger." So of course I stood there among the spider webs and laundry lint and put the 7,000 pieces together until there she was, sculpted and bedazzling, in all her not-sugar glory. It felt a little like someone had stabbed me in the gut. But that was all it did. By the time I scooped the 7,000 pieces of her into my palms and returned them to their rightful place in the envelope, that feeling was just a tiny punch. I took a walk with Mr. Sugar later that day, and I told him what I'd found, and we laughed about it a little. And even though I already knew the story of the woman who was in 7,000 tiny pieces, I asked him about her again, what drew him to her, what they did together, and why he did with her what he did. And by the time we were done talking, I didn't feel anything in my gut anymore. I only felt closer to him. I felt that way because we were closer. Not because I more deeply understood the woman who makes me look like the Pillsbury Doughboy, but because I more deeply understood Mr. Sugar's inner sanctum. The jealous fire that's burning in you, haunted. The one that speaks up when your man tries to share stories of his sexual past with you, is keeping you from being close to him. The women your lover knew and loved and fucked and had wild orgies with before you are pieces of his life. He wants to tell you about them because he wants to deepen his relationship with you, to share things about himself that he doesn't share with many others. This is called intimacy. This is called fuck yes. When people do this with us, it's an honor. And when the people who do this with us also happen to be people with whom we are falling in love, it lets us into an orbit in which there is only admission for two. Isn't that cool? It is. It really is, Pumpkin. It's gratitude that you should be feeling in place of jealousy and insecurity and fear when your lover shares stories of his life with you. I encourage you to reach for that gratitude. It's located just a stretch beyond the crazed fire that's burning in your head. I'm certain that if you apply some effort, you'll have it in hand. Please read the letter you wrote to me out loud to your boyfriend. This will be embarrassing, but do it anyway. Tell him how you feel without making him responsible for your feelings. Ask him what his motivations are for telling you stories of his sexual past. Ask him if he'd like to hear about your own sexual experiences. Then take turns telling each other one story that makes each of you feel a little bit like you've been stabbed in the gut. Let yourself be gutted. Let it open you. Start there. Yours, Sugar. A Big Life. Dear Sugar, my question is not about love or sex, but rather one of identity and striving for the best quality of life possible. I, as many other Americans, am struggling financially. Student loans are continuously on my mind and are the cause of almost every stress in my life. My parents graciously co-signed for my student loans. However, I am being forced to consolidate in order to relieve them of this duty. I realize this is more out of necessity than spite, yet the situation greatly impacts my already poor financial situation and also my dream of attending graduate school. I'm so angry with my parents for putting me in this circumstance instead of supporting me to get a graduate degree for my dream job, and I feel selfish about that. My relationship with my parents has always been rocky to the point that I've come to realize I'll never get any emotional support from them. I'm grateful they were able to help me with an undergraduate degree. However, I have never been close to them, and I'm often wary of their intentions. Our phone conversations are 100% concerning student loans, rather than me as a person. I struggle with student loans often defining me. I know my education, student loans, and occupation will define me to an extent. However, I'm more than my job and these items combined. I'm a 25-year-old woman who strives for the greatest possible quality of life and to be the best person she can be. But more often than not, I'm defined by my student loan identity. It is on my mind when I grab a beer, buy new clothes, and in general live my life. I do not spend excessively and have always had careful money management. Yet this situation extends beyond any careful money management. I have always reached to have a positive spin on life. I fell into a deep dark hole a few years ago and have crawled out slowly myself. I purposely changed what I didn't like about my life. It wasn't an easy process by any means, but I'm finally in a place where I can breathe. Yet the stresses of student loans bear greatly, and I'm having trouble keeping up any positive outlook. Sugar, I would love your perspective on this situation. I wish my parents would see me for the vibrant woman I am. I wish I could see myself as the vibrant young woman I strive to be and would like to be in the future. Sincerely, Wearing Thin. Dear Wearing Thin, I received zero funding from my parents for my undergraduate education, or from relatives of any sort, for that matter. It wasn't that my mother and stepfather didn't want to help me financially. It was that they couldn't. There was never any question about whether I'd need to fend for myself financially once I was able to. I had to, so I did. I got a job when I was 14 and kept one all through high school. The money I earned went to things like clothes, school activity fees, a junked-out car, gas, car insurance, movie tickets, mascara, and so on. My parents were incredibly generous people. Everything they had, they shared with my siblings and me. They housed me, they fed me, and they went to great lengths to create wonderful Christmases. But from a very young age, if I wanted something, I usually had to buy it myself. My parents were strapped. Most winters, there would be a couple of months so lean that my mother would have to go to the local food bank for groceries. In the years that the program was in place, My family received blocks of cheese and bags of powdered milk from the federal government. My health insurance all through my childhood was Medicaid, coverage for kids living in poverty. I moved out of my parents' house a month before my 18th birthday. With a combination of personal earnings, grants, scholarships, and student loans, I funded the bachelor's degree in English and women's studies that I'm still paying for. As of today, I owe $4,876. Over the years, I've taken to saying, sometimes with astonishment, other times with anger, but mostly with a sense of resigned, distorted glee, I'll be paying off my student loans until I'm 43. But you know what? I'm waving to you from the shores of 43, and the months are peeling away. It's looking extremely likely that I'll still be paying off my student loans when I'm 44. Has this ruined my life? Has it kept me from pursuing happiness, my writing career, and ridiculously expensive cowboy boots? Has it compelled me to turn away from fantastically financially unsound expenditures on fancy dinners, travel, organic shampoo, and high-end preschools? Has it stopped me from adopting cats who immediately need thousands of dollars in veterinary care, or funding dozens of friends' artistic projects on Kickstarter, putting $20 bottles of wine on my credit card, or getting the occasional pedicure? It has not. I have carried the weight of my student loan debt for about half of my life now, but I have not been, quote, defined by my student loan identity. I do not even know what a student loan identity is. Do you? What is a student loan identity? It is, I guess, exactly what you're stuck with if you can't get some perspective on this matter, sweet pea. It's the threadbare cape you've wrapped around yourself, composed of self-pitying half-truth. And it absolutely will not serve you. You need to stop feeling sorry for yourself. I don't say this as a condemnation. I need regular reminders to stop feeling sorry for myself, too. I'm going to address you bluntly, but it's a directness that rises from my compassion for you, not my judgment of you. Nobody's going to do your life for you. You have to do it yourself, whether you're rich or poor, out of money or raking it in, the beneficiary of ridiculous fortune or terrible injustice. And you have to do it no matter what is true, no matter what is hard, no matter what unjust, sad, sucky things have befallen you. Self-pity is a dead-end road. You make the choice to drive down it. It's up to you to decide to stay parked there or turn around and drive out. You have driven out at least once already, wearing thin. You found yourself in a deep dark hole a while back, and then you courageously crawled out. You have to do it again. Your student loans will only hold you back if you allow them to. Yep, you have to figure out how to pay them. Yep, you can do that. Yep, it's a pain in the ass. But it's a pain in the ass that I promise will give you back more than you owe. You know the best thing about paying your own bills? No one can tell you what to do with your money. You say your parents are emotionally unsupportive. You say you're wary of their intentions. You say they don't see you for the vibrant woman that you are. Well, the moment you sign that paper absolving them of their financial obligation to your debts, you are free. You may love them, you may despise them, you may choose to have whatever sort of relationship you choose to have with them, but you are no longer beholden to them in this one particular and important way. You are financially accountable only to yourself. If they express disdain for the jobs you have or the way you spend your money, you can rightly tell them it's none of their damn business. They have absolutely no power over you in this regard. No one does. That's a mighty liberating thing. And it's a hard thing, too. I know, honey bun. I really, really, really do. Many years ago, I ran into an acquaintance I'll call Kate a few days after we both graduated college, though in my case, I'm using the word graduated rather liberally. See the chapter, The Future Has an Ancient Heart. Kate was with her parents, who'd not only paid for her entire education, but also for her junior year abroad in Spain and her summer educational opportunities that included unpaid internships at places like GQ magazine and language immersions in France and fascinating archaeological digs and God knows what fantastically interesting place. As we stood on the sidewalk chatting, I was informed that A, Kate's parents had given her a brand new car for her graduation present, and B, Kate and her mother had spent the day shopping for the new wardrobe Kate would need for her first ever job. Not that she had one, mind you. She was applying for jobs while living off her parents' money, of course. She was sending out her glorious resume that included the names of foreign countries and trendy magazines to places that were no doubt equally glorious, and I knew without knowing something simply glorious would be the result. It was all I could do not to sock her in the gut. Unlike Kate, by then, I'd had a job. In fact, I'd had 16 jobs, not including the years I worked as a babysitter before I could legally be anyone's employee. They were janitor's assistant, humiliatingly, at my high school, fast food restaurant worker, laborer at a wildlife refuge, administrative assistant to a realtor, English as a second language tutor, lemonade cart attendant, small town newspaper reporter, canvasser for a lefty nonprofit, waitress at a Japanese restaurant, volunteer coordinator for a reproductive rights organization, berry picker on a farm, waitress at a vegetarian restaurant, coffee girl at an accounting firm, student faculty conflict mediator, teacher's assistant for a women's studies class, an office temp at a half dozen places that by and large did not resemble offices and did not engage me in work that struck me as remotely officey, but rather involved things such as standing on a concrete floor, wearing a hairnet, a paper mask and gown, goggles, and plastic gloves, and with a pair of tweezers, placing two pipe cleaners into a sterile box that came to me down a slow conveyor belt for 8 excruciating hours a day. During those years, I sometimes wept with rage. My dream was to be a writer. I wanted it so badly that it made my insides hurt. And to be a writer, I felt sure, I needed to have a big life, which at the time meant to me amazing experiences such as the sort Kate had. I needed to experience culture and see the world. I needed to speak French and hang out with people who knew people who worked at GQ. Instead, I was forced by accident of birth to work one job after another in a desperate attempt to pay the bills. It was so damn unfair. Why did Kate get to study in Spain her junior year? Why did she get to write the word France on her resume? Why did she get her bachelor's degree debt-free, and then on top of that, a new car? Why did she get two parents who would be her financial fallback for years to come, and then decades into a future which has not yet come to pass, leave her an inheritance upon their deaths? I didn't get an inheritance. My mother died 3 months before I graduated college, and all I got was her ancient, rusted-out Toyota that I quickly sold to a guy named Guy for $500. Bloody hell. So here's the long and short of it, wearing thin. There is no why. You don't have a right to the cards you believe you should have been dealt. You have an obligation to play the hell out of the ones you're holding. And dear one, you and I both were granted a mighty generous hand. Your parents helped you pay for your undergraduate education while you were a student, and presuming you didn't graduate at 25, a presumption which may or may not be correct, they also helped you during the years immediately following your graduation. They've declined to continue to assist you, not because they wish to punish you, but because doing so would be difficult for them. This strikes me as perfectly reasonable and fair. You are an educated adult of sound mind, able body, and resilient spirit, who has absolutely no reason not to be financially self-sufficient, even if doing so requires you to earn money in ways you find unpleasant. Your parents' inability to continue paying your student loans will prevent you from realizing your dreams of attending graduate school only if you let it. Are you really not going to pursue your dream because you now have one more bill than you had before? Are you truly so cowed by adversity? You don't mention what you'd like to study, but I assure you there are many ways to fund a graduate education. I know a whole lot of people who did not go broke getting a graduate degree. There is funding for tuition remission at many schools, as well as grants, paid research, and teaching assistantships, and yes, the offer of more student loans. Perhaps more importantly in your case, there are numerous ways to either cancel portions of your student loan debt or defer payment. Financial difficulty, unemployment, attending school at least half-time, i.e. graduate school, working in certain professions, and serving in the Peace Corps or other community service jobs are some ways that you would be eligible for debt deferment or cancellation. I encourage you to investigate your options so you can make a plan that brings you peace of mind. There are many websites that will elucidate what I have summarized above. What I know for sure is that freaking out about your student loan debt is useless. You'll be okay. It's only money. And it was money well spent. Aside from the people I love, there is little I value more than my education. As soon as I pay off my undergraduate debt, Mr. Sugar and I intend to start saving for college for the baby Sugars. My dream is that they'll have college experiences that resemble Kate's more than mine. I want them to be able to focus on their studies instead of cramming them in around jobs. I want them to have a junior year abroad wherever they want to go. I want them to have cool internships that they could only take with parental financial support. I want them to go on cultural exchanges and interesting archaeological digs. I want to fund all that stuff I never got to do because no one was able to fund me. I can imagine all they would gain from that. But I can also imagine what they won't get if Mr. Sugar and I manage to give them the college experience of my dreams. Turns out, I learned a lot from not being able to go to France. Turns out, those days standing on the concrete floor wearing a hairnet, a paper mask and gown, goggles, and plastic gloves, and with a pair of tweezers, placing two pipe cleaners into a sterile box that came to me down a slow conveyor belt for 8 excruciating hours a day, taught me something important I couldn't have learned any other way. That job and the 15 others I had before I graduated college were my own personal educational opportunities. They changed my life for the better, though it took me a while to understand their worth. They gave me faith in my own abilities. They offered me a unique view of worlds that were both exotic and familiar to me. They kept things in perspective. They pissed me off. They opened my mind to realities I didn't know existed. They forced me to be resilient, to sacrifice, to see how little I knew, and also how much. They put me in close contact with people who could have funded the college educations of 10,000 kids, and also with people who would have rightly fallen on the floor laughing had I complained to them about how unfair it was that after I got my degree, I'd have this student loan I'd be paying off until I was 43. They made my life big. They contributed to an education that money can't buy. Yours, Sugar. The Known Unknowns. Dear Sugar, I dated this girl for a while, only to reach the realization she was a self-absorbed crazy. Last year, she and her best friend got into an argument, and they stopped being friends. My ex's friend called me up one night and asked me to hang out with her at her house. One thing led to another, and I ended up sleeping with her. A few days later, this former best friend of my ex tells me she's engaged. She wears this weird, short-haired wig while she breaks off our friends with benefits relationship. The thing is, I connected better with her in the 2 weeks we hung out than I did with my ex in months. Please help me figure out if I should never talk to either one of them again. I'm not a smart man, but I do know what love is. Gump. Dear Gump, I'd rather be sodomized by a plastic lawn flamingo than vote for a Republican. But as I consider your situation, I can't help but quote the former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who quite wisely said, "There are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know we don't know." Shall we start with the known knowns when it comes to your little triangular quagmire, Gump? A. You found your ex-girlfriend to be crazy and broke up with her. B. You fucked your ex-girlfriend's ex-best friend for a fortnight and felt, quote, connected. C. In spite of such connection, your ex-girlfriend's ex-best friend donned a wig and announced that she has no interest in continuing to fuck you, claiming to be on the brink of a presumably monogamous and eternal connection to someone else. Which brings us to the known unknowns. A. Why the wig? And if the wig, why the unnervingly short hair? B. Is the ex-girlfriend's ex-best friend actually engaged to be married? Or is this simply a grandiose ruse to shake you from her disinterested but chicken shit tail? C. How can it be that so many people's ex-girlfriends are crazy? What happens to these women? Do they eventually go on to birth babies and care for their elderly parents and scramble up gigantic pans of eggs on Sunday mornings for oodles of loungeabouts who later have the nerve to inquire about what's for dinner? Or is there some corporate rest home for crazy bitches chain in cities across the land that I'm unaware of that houses all these women who used to love men who later claimed they were actually crazy bitches? Lastly, there are the unknown unknowns, the things, Gump, that you don't know you don't know. A. You have nothing for these women. B. These women have nothing for you. C. And yet. D. And yet. E. You are loved. Yours, Sugar. On Your Island. Dear Sugar, I'm transgender. Born female 28 years ago, I knew I was meant to be male for as long as I can remember. I had the usual painful childhood and adolescence in a smallish town because I was different, picked on by other kids, misunderstood by my otherwise loving family. 7 years ago, I told my mom and dad I intended to have a sex change. They were furious and disturbed by my news. They said the worst things you can imagine anyone saying to another human being, especially if that human being is your child. In response, I cut off ties with them and moved to the city where I live now and made a new life living as a man. I have friends and romance in my life. I love my job. I'm happy with who I've become and the life I've made. It's like I've created an island far away and safe from my past. I like it that way. A couple of weeks ago, after years of no contact, I got an email from my parents that blew my mind. They apologized for how they'd responded when I told them about my plans for a sex change. They said they were sorry they never understood, and now they do, or at least enough that we could have a relationship again. They said they miss me, and they love me. Sugar, they want me back. I cried like crazy, and that surprised me. I know this might sound odd, but I believed I didn't love my parents anymore, or at least my love had become abstract since they had rejected me and because we've not been in touch. But when I got that email, a lot of emotions that I thought were dead came back to life. This scares me. I have made it because I'm tough. I'm an orphan, but I was doing great without my parents. Do I cave and forgive them and get back in touch and even go visit them as they have asked me to do? Or do I email them and say thank you, but letting you back into my life is out of the question given our past? Orphan. Dear Orphan, please forgive your parents. Not for them, for you. You've earned the next thing that will happen if you do. You've remade yourself already. You and your mom and dad can remake this too, the new era in which they are finally capable of loving the real you. Let them. Love them back. See how that feels. What they did to you 7 years ago is terrible. They now know that. They're sorry. They've grown and changed and come to understand things that confounded them before. Refusing to accept them for the people they've become over these years of your estrangement isn't all that different from them refusing to accept you for who you are. It's fear-based and punishing. It's weak rather than tough. You're tough. You've had to ask impossible questions, endure humiliations, suffer internal conflicts, and redefine your life in ways that most people don't and can't even imagine. But you know what? So have your parents. They had a girl child who became what they didn't expect. They were cruel and small when you needed them most, but only because they were drowning in their own fear and ignorance. They aren't drowning anymore. It took them 7 years, but they swam to shore. They have arrived at last on your island. Welcome them. Yours, Sugar. Part 4. You don't have to be broken for me. Some interesting questions I've gathered along the way. If love were an animal, what species would it be, and could you train it? Love would be two animals, a hummingbird and a snake. Both are perfectly untrainable. What's a weird thing that happened to you? One time I was hiking up a mountain in New Mexico. It was March, the trail still covered with snow in places. There was no one around but me for hours until I came upon two people, a man and a woman, who had just come upon each other. We were three strangers who met on a mountain in New Mexico. We got to talking, and somehow within the first 5 minutes of knowing each other, we figured out that we all had the same birthday. And not only that, we were born in three consecutive years. As we were talking, three feathers blew up to us on the snow. We picked them up. What do you do when you don't know what to do about something? I talk to Mr. Sugar and my friends. I make lists. I attempt to analyze the situation from the perspective of my best self, the one that's generous, reasonable, forgiving, loving, big-hearted, and grateful. I think really hard about what I'll wish I did a year from now. I map out the consequences of the various actions I could take. I ask what my motivations are, what my desires are, what my fears are, what I have to lose, and what I have to gain. I move toward the light, even if it's a hard direction in which to move. I trust myself. I keep the faith. I mess up sometimes. What are your spiritual beliefs? I do not believe in God as most people conceive of God, but I believe there is a divine spirit in each of us. I believe there is something bigger than our individual selves that we can touch when we live our lives with integrity, compassion, and love. What would you like to tell us about sex? Snakes, hummingbirds, perhaps a polar bear. The magic of wanting to be. Dear Sugar, I'm a 64-year-old man who has been single for the past 5 years. My most recent romantic relationship lasted 10 years, 8 of which were wonderful. My ex had 4 adult children and 3 grandchildren. I liked her children a lot, and I loved her grandkids. The year after our relationship ended was the most painful time of my life. This, even though I'd lost my father in high school, spent a year in Vietnam, and watched another lover die of cancer. To survive my heartbreak, I started to do lots of community volunteer work. In the past 4 years, I've been involved with hospice. I've served on the board of directors of a nonprofit agency that provides services to survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. I've tutored students at a middle school, and I've worked at an AIDS hotline. During this time, I've had a few dates with women I've met via internet dating services and found one good friend among them, but no romance. I've had one sexual encounter since my ex and I broke up, which I paid for. It wasn't very satisfying. I miss sex a lot, but I also miss having someone to talk with over a meal or coffee. There's a new volunteer coordinator at the AIDS hotline where I volunteer, and she's wonderful. She's so exciting that I overcame my fears and asked her out to see a play with me. She said she couldn't go because she had a friend visiting from out of town. I believed that. I know I should ask her out again since she seemed willing, but one of my fears is that I'm old enough to be her father. I don't want to be a dirty old man. My counselor said, just be light at first. Start easy and be funny. Be Cary Grant, she said. But I don't know if I can do that, Sugar. I give to lots of people, but I have emotional needs too. I want sex, affection, and emotional closeness. I want someone to care about me. I know people do care about me already, but I want someone special. I want to be loved and to receive love, to have someone there for me. My hunger for this is so great that I fear it's too much to ask anyone for. I'm afraid that if the volunteer coordinator did go out with me, I'd share all this with her at once, and though she'd be compassionate, She'd be scared off because she'd perceive me as needy. Of course, I know that even if the volunteer coordinator and I did start seeing each other, she may not be the person for me, or I the person for her. But I want to take that chance and see. I don't want my fear to get in the way. What do you think, Sugar? Fear of asking too much. Dear fear of asking too much, of course you want someone special to love you. A majority of the people who write to me inquire about how they can get the same thing. Some are, quote, hot, smart, and 25. Others are 42, a bit chubby, but lots of fun. And others awesome, but in a muddle. Many are teens and early 20-somethings whose hearts have just been seriously broken for the first time, and they are quite convinced they'll never find a love like that again. A few are seasoned, experienced grown-ups like you, whose faith in the prospect is waning. Unique as every letter is, the point each writer reaches is the same. I want love, and I'm afraid I'll never get it. It's hard to answer those letters because I'm an advice columnist, not a fortune teller. I have words instead of a crystal ball. I can't say when you'll get love, or how you'll find it, or even promise that you will. I can only say you are worthy of it, and that it's never too much to ask for it, and that it's not crazy to fear you'll never have it again, even though your fears are probably wrong. Love is our essential nutrient. Without it, life has little meaning. It's the best thing we have to give, and the most valuable thing we receive. It's worthy of all the hullabaloo. It seems to me that you're doing everything right, darling. I plucked your letter out of the enormous How Do I Get Love pile because I was struck by the integrity with which you describe your situation. You're looking for love, not letting that keep you from living your life. In the face of your most recent and considerable heartbreak, you opted not to wallow. Instead, you gave generously of yourself by committing to work that's meaningful to you and important to your community. It's no surprise to me that it was in the course of that work you've met someone who genuinely sparks your interest. So let's talk about her, the exciting volunteer coordinator. I agree with you that you shouldn't let your fears get in the way of asking her out. Just don't allow yourself to take it too personally if she says no. I can think of two reasons she might turn you down. One is your significant age difference. Many women will date outside their age bracket, but some won't. The other is your status as a volunteer for the agency that employs her. She may be constrained by workplace policies that prohibit her from dating you. Or she may have a personal boundary about doing so. She does, after all, hold a position of professional authority in relation to you. You won't know either until you find out. I suggest you ask her on a date without specifying the day or time or occasion, so you can avoid the uncertainty of another impossible to interpret, I'd love to, but scenario. Just tell her that you think she's great, and you wonder if she'd like to go out with you sometime. She'll either say yes or no or okay, but only as friends. I agree with your counselor that light and easy is the way to begin, with her and with any woman you ask out, even if you have to fake it for a while. Which happens to be precisely what Cary Grant did. He wasn't born a suave and bedazzling movie star. He wasn't even born Cary Grant. He was a lonely kid whose depressed mother was sent to a madhouse without his knowledge when he was 9 or 10. His father told him she'd gone on an extended vacation. He didn't know what became of her until he was well into his 30s, when he discovered her still institutionalized, but alive. He was kicked out of school in England at 14, and by 16 he was traveling across the United States, performing as a stilt walker, an acrobat, and mime. Eventually, he found his calling as an actor and changed his name to the one we know him by, the name your counselor invoked because it's synonymous with male charisma and charm and fabulousness. But he was always still that boy inside. Of himself, Grant said, "I pretended to be somebody I wanted to be, and I finally became that person, or he became me, or we met at some point." I suggest you take that approach. It's not about becoming a movie star. It's about the down-in-the-dirt art of inhabiting the person you aspire to be while carrying on your shoulders the uncertain and hungry man you know you are. Your longing for love is only one part of you. I know that it feels gigantic when you're all alone writing to me, or when you imagine going out on that first date with a woman you desire. But don't let your need be the only thing you show. It will scare people off. It will misrepresent how much you have to offer.